for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama appeared on every major news program yesterday except Fox. His aim? To add urgency and direction to the national debate on health care. Thus far, a divisive debate in Congress and across the nation. Joining me to talk about where the debate on health care reform goes from here, Susan Dentzer. She's editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and on-air analyst on health issues for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Ralph Neese is chief executive of the National Coalition on Health Care. And Gail Walensky is an economist. She's senior fellow at Project Hope. And, of course, we'd like to hear from you, your thoughts, ideas. Give us a call on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Susan Dentzer, no president has ever done what President Obama did yesterday. What do you think he accomplished?
I think in addition to just getting exceptional media exposure in a very efficient way, what he managed to do was a few things. First of all, he's continuing, I think, to stop the slide in public opinion over health care reform that took place from June on. And he may not have turned public opinion around, but he probably has broken the slide for now. I think he's also added, obviously, as you said, a sense of urgency to the debate. And frankly, he's still out there for the vast majority of the American public clarifying some of the details. Much of the public is just now tuning into the details of health reform. The president made the correct, I think, legislative strategy early on to let Congress work its way through the legislation, but it might not have been the best public relations strategy because he needed probably to be clearer earlier of what the goal of health reform was and make that more obvious to the American public. And he's now, in effect, playing a catch-up game, I think, and trying to accomplish that.
Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and on-air analyst for health issues with the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And to you, Gail Walensky, the president said that, as Susan has mentioned, health care proposals have not been explained sufficiently fully to the American public. Would you agree?
I do agree. Health care reform is complicated. People understand some concepts, like those who don't have health insurance or the costs that they're facing. There are a lot of provisions in the bill. It's important that people understand we are, after all, talking about one-sixth of the whole economy. We want to be sure that we don't have unintended consequences of a significant order. Of course, there'll be some.
Gail Walensky of Project Hope and Ralph Neese, the major, major argument is over affordability. Explain the issues there.
There is nothing more important in terms of the sustainability of health care reform unless we have a budget neutral bill, but very importantly, how do we slow the increase of cost year by year? A lot of Americans are beginning to understand, and let's face it, at the end of August, two-thirds of them were confused about health care reform, and I think the president's doing a good job of saying, here's how it benefits every American family. But health care costs, health care premiums have gone up 130% over the last decade, while wages have gone up 34%. Half of all foreclosures and benefits are because people can't pay their medical bills. Affordability and cost containment, cost management are the issues that we're going to be focusing on, I think, primarily over the next 100 days.
Ralph Neese, he's chief executive of the National Coalition on Health Care. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Gail, what about this bill that Max Baucus reported out? People are saying there's plenty to argue about, but at the same time, it's the best hope.
compromises aren't pretty, and I think we're seeing that from the Baucus bill. What needs to happen if we're going to get health care reform, and not just health insurance reform, which is a lot of what we've been talking about, important as that is to try and find 60 votes in the Senate. That will allow legislation that will not just focus on spending, on the deficit, but will allow us to look at the broader issues of how to try to improve the delivery of health care, improve the value for the money we spent that Ralph was just talking about. There are problems with the Baucus bill, but it attempts to reach out to people who have said they're not going to support a public plan, people like Ben Nelson. I'm talking about the Democrats. This is primarily how do you craft a bill that brings in all or as many as possible of the Democrats and maybe one or two Republicans. I think this is the beginning of a bill that could do that. Needs to be changed a little. There's some harshness about that individual mandate for people who don't buy insurance, who might be just above the cutoff for subsidies. There are other issues that are going to get raised, but this might be the kernel of the bill that could actually get through the Senate.
But help me understand, Susan Dancer, there have already been 564 amendments to this bill. Republicans are saying, on the one hand, scratch this whole thing, start from the beginning. On the other hand, as you just heard Gail say, some Democrats are saying this could be the beginning.
I think what you're seeing here is the classic political positioning. The most important thing in the legislative process is to get a train moving. This train is moving. And now people have something to begin to look at closely and amend. That's why you're seeing these 500 amendments, and I'm sure we'll see probably at least that many more. So when the Republicans are saying we have to start all over again, that's almost a way of saying, let's block the process. Let's stop the process in its tracks. I think, as Gail says, there's enough in this bill which could be the focus of a compromise that frankly, the people who want to block it are worried about that. And that's why you're getting a lot of this rhetoric around start all over again.
Gail?
I agree. And I think one of the most important issues is, unlike the House bill, this has been declared budget neutral, not only in the first 10 years, which is hard enough, but in the out years as well. That's a critical issue. The president keeps saying it has to be budget neutral. The Congress has been saying in its many ways it has to be budget neutral. The economy, since we've had the deficit increased by three or four times, is also indicating budget neutral is an issue. So while there are going to be a lot of exchanges back and forth about what people will need to see changed to support this bill, I do believe this is right now the best vehicle we see for getting to that magic 60-vote number so you can include broad health care reform and not just those issues involving the deficit.
But what about all these protests, Ralph, that we're seeing across the country? I realize that since August, they seem to have died down somewhat. But nevertheless, you've still got a lot of people saying, don't touch my health care.
There's no question that the opposition to a health care reform had a tremendous month in August. A lot of ground was lost. However, if you had asked me on January 20th, would I be happy just after Labor Day to be out of four committees and almost out of a fifth, I would have said I'd be ecstatic. So we did lose ground in August, but I do think, as Gail and Susan have said, we have recaptured some of the momentum because of the president. But the confusion, the skepticism is there. And it's not just the right wing or the extreme far right. It's two-thirds of this country saying, I'm confused. And its message has got to be clearer and more concise. But Olympia Snowe is the key here. And she said very good things.
How so?
Well, she is the one who is saying, listen, I could go with a trigger mechanism on the public health
what
option.
What does that mean?
That means after 3 or 4 years or whatever she puts into her amendment, if costs do not come down, if this insurance reform that Gail was talking about doesn't work the way the insurance companies others say it will work, then a public option would kick in.
But, Susan, let's talk about the difference, as Gail mentioned, between the cost of the House bill and the stated cost of the Senate bill.
Yes, and when we say the train is leaving the station, we shouldn't understate the many differences that will have to be bridged before it arrives at the destination. And that cost is one of them. Part of the reason that many people on the left are upset about the Baucus bill is that it costs so little. The subsidies that are available to help people buy insurance are much lower than they are.
So it's $774 billion.
Exactly right. And the as distinct from more than $1 trillion
right.
for the House bill. So the Senate bill, of course, has the individual mandate in it, as does the House bill. But it's basically asking people who are not particularly high income to spend 13% of their incomes on health insurance. And that is going to be a big wake-up call for many Americans. So you have people on the left saying, wait a minute, you're not subsidizing these people enough. You're not giving them the public option that I like. You are giving them instead co-ops, which I think will never come into existence. In fact, even the Congressional Budget Office looked at co-ops and said they will have almost no effect in attracting people to join them. So there is a lot of cause for concern on the part of the left as there is on the part of the right.
Let me give you some example of the kind of trade-offs you might see coming down to respond to the issue that Susan just mentioned. You could introduce a soft mandate the way Massachusetts has. What I mean by that is for the first several years, the penalties may either be waived entirely or they might be phased in.
If you don't buy insurance. I see.
You could put in a little extra money to try to bridge where the subsidies drop off, so it's not quite so harsh.
Gail Walensky of Project Hope, Ralph Knees of the National Coalition on Healthcare, Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. Short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We were talking about the president's media blitz over the weekend, how much of an impact it did have, whether the Baucus bill that has now come out of the Senate Finance Committee with something like 564 amendments is going to become what we ultimately get. But everybody is saying lots of sausage on this one. You want to go back to Olympia Snow, Ralph Knees.
Right, because we do have problems with the bill on affordability and system-wide reform and a number of other issues. But Olympia Snow is so important. There was an interview, I believe, in the New York Times today with John Harwood, which she basically said, I'm willing to work with the president and with Senator Baucus, and I'm willing to stand up to the entire Republican conference if necessary, something Chuck Grassley and others have not done. So I would look at Olympia Snow and Susan Collins and then Joe Lieberman and Nelson of Nebraska as the top three or four people. If those people or two or three of them go with the rest of the Democrats, and there really are a dozen other Democratic targets who are the blue dog equivalency in the Senate.
But that
60 on cloture and then let people go up and down on the final passage vote, but That 60 would prevent reconciliation, which would be a Rube Goldberg mess. We wouldn't oppose it, but that's looking into the abyss when you talk about reconciliation and what could happen under those circumstances.
There's one more name to add to Ralph's list, which is George Voinovich of Ohio, who is a Republican moderate who's going to be retiring and has, in effect, nothing to lose by caucusing on this one with the Democrats, it is said.
But,
so they're going to work hard to get him as well.
It's interesting when you say has nothing to lose. You sort of put this in the political camp rather than in the what do the American people need camp.
Well, unfortunately, that is
the
reality.
Way it is.
And the three Republican members of Baucus's so-called Gang of Six were under extraordinary pressure not to engage in discussions to forge a bipartisan bill.
Pressure from whom?
From the rest of the party, from the party leadership. This is construed as the defining moment of the Obama presidency. And if it is blocked, it is perceived that this would be a major Republican victory, at least by some in the party.
And people are saying, indeed, that if this health care bill goes down, it would be the end of the Democratic Party. Gail?
That just is silly talk. It would be a major loss. If the American people aren't happy with what actually gets passed, it could be at least as bad for the Democratic Party. People are forgetting about our experience of catastrophic insurance, the first one in 1988, where a bill was passed. It did not meet with the approval of the American public after the fact, probably because of a lot of confusion. It had aspects that have some similarity. The tax collecting part started first before the benefits, which is an attribute of most of these plans that we're talking about, and the repeal occurred a year later in 1989. So while I think this would be a major defeat, I do believe that there are some Republicans who are looking at whether or not their constituents support this kind of bill. And that's why you're seeing somebody like Olympia Snowe and possibly Susan Collins, who come from more liberal states than a lot of the Republicans, saying, I could, under some circumstances, support this bill. All politicians face the problem of needing to be reelected. I mean, that is a fact of life. There are clearly some who have taken the position, we want to defeat this bill because it'll help the Republican Party. That's unfortunate. This is a serious American problem that really needs to be resolved. Fortunately, there are some that are willing to look at it that way.
What about the proposal to tax high-cost health insurance, Ralph?
On the one hand, there's no question that the insurance industry and the pharmaceuticals and the doctors and a hospital should be part of a shared responsibility, shared sacrifice in terms of addressing the short-term and long-term cost management issues and the affordability issues. Unfortunately, the way this is drafted, I'm afraid that there's a potential for cost shifting from the insurance companies to the people who are buying the insurance. And I think this makes it a very vulnerable proposition, and I'm not sure it's crafted in terms of affordability also. And the people who have to be part of this, the affordability issues, I think, especially with the middle class, are the toughest ones, but the cost shifting could just add to that.
But what about the people who pay large amounts, the so-called VIP MD programs? What happens there?
The whole purpose of putting this tax is to have the equivalent of what was called the tax cap activity. That is to try to put pressure on people who have very expensive plans to look for more cost-effective plans. That is the point. It's a clumsy way to do what has been considered in the past, usually by Republicans, which is to limit the tax benefits to plans that are below a certain amount. Now, this limit's pretty high. It's proposed at $21,000 for a family of four. The average right now is $12,000 or $13,000 or $8,000 for an individual policy. It's a clumsy way to do it. Of course it'll be passed back to the individual. That's the whole point. In fact, the same argument can be made for some of the excise taxes that are being proposed on the pharmaceutical companies and the device companies. They're like sales taxes. They will be passed back to the users of the service, it will make healthcare more expensive, a little counterintuitive.
Susan, what about questions over malpractice reform?
Well, the president, I think, surprised some in the Republican caucus by at least opening the door to, and we shouldn't overstate what he did here. What he did say was that malpractice is a problem, that it does lead physicians and others to perform more tests, so-called defensive medicine, and take other steps to guard against being found guilty in a malpractice suit, frankly. And so the president said there are a number of states that have proposed alternative solutions to the classic tort system, that is to say, suing somebody in court, asking for large damages. And the traditional Republican solution has been to cap the so-called non-economic damages, that is to say, punitive damages and damages for pain and suffering. The president said, let's not necessarily go that direction, but let's look at some other mechanisms that we might launch some pilot projects on in various states,
now,
health courts,
might that,
et cetera.
Might that, in fact, draw Republican support to the bill? Or are they simply saying, with the exceptions of the few you talked about, nobody votes for this bill?
I think it's more likely to keep doctors and others in the country on board to understanding that the president recognizes that they have this problem with defensive medicine and with malpractice. The administration actually wanted to go even farther, but was not able to persuade the trial lawyers, who are big Democratic supporters, to sign off on more dramatic initiatives in this regard. So I think at most, this will basically keep doctors aware of the fact that there are some provisions in the bill that they might like.
And now you've got Senate Finance Committee member Robert Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey. He wants changes for illegal immigrants. What are those, Ralph?
Senator Menendez and Senator Rockefeller, I think, are going to give Senator Max Baucus fits this week during the markup that will be occurring. The president has made it very clear that illegal immigrants will not be covered by the bill. And whatever the merits of that argument, it's pretty clear that on both sides of the Hill that that's probably going to be the case. I would hope that there will be more liberal positions with respect to undocumented immigrants and the children of immigrants or mixed families. But in terms of illegal immigrants, it's going to be really tough to pass such an
amendment. But hasn't Senator Rockefeller already said, because there is no public option, he doesn't want to be part of this bill?
Yes, he has said that. He has also, and he has really downplayed the likely effectiveness of the alternative mechanism, co-ops, as I said earlier. On top of that, he's concerned about another provision of the bill, which over time would take the Children's Health Insurance Program and fold that in to the coverage that is available to people through the insurance exchanges.
The so-called SCHIP plan.
Mm-hmm. referred to as CHIP, exactly. And what would happen to the CHIP program is it would become a kind of a wraparound policy around private health insurance.
Boy, this gets complicated.
Indeed.
Health insurance is complicated.
Health insurance is complicated. But, you know, in response to President Obama's media blitz, Republicans sent out an email message saying, if it's Sunday, it's misleading the press. So it makes you wonder if there's any hope of real compromise.
This is certainly the most challenging measure substantively and politically I've ever encountered in 35 years,
really?
Without question. One thing that we should note, and I think all four of us know this, and I bet you most of the viewers know, and listeners know, the insurance industry, the pharmaceuticals, the doctors, the hospitals are still at the table. This was not the case in 93 and 94. And the reason they're still at the table is that there are 20 or 30 or 40 million new customers and clients and patients if there is comprehensive health care reform. This provides momentum that was not there 15 years ago and gives us more hope that the tough political compromises ahead of us can end successfully. No guarantees, but I think that there will be a good health care reform bill before the president, but it's going to take some time between Thanksgiving and Christmas at best.
You know, there, and I'm sure you all saw it, there was a Harvard Medical School report stating that there are 45,000 deaths each year simply because people have no health insurance. Susan.
Yes, and that builds on a study that the Institute of Medicine released several years ago that pegged the number lower at 18,000 a year. Although if you talk to people who were in on that study, they thought that that number was a conservative estimate. So whether it's 18,000, whether it's 45,000, we do know that coverage contributes to premature mortality for many, lack of coverage contributes to premature mortality for many, many individuals because they tend to get care, but they get care late. They tend to not be able to afford preventive medicine, preventive screenings, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this adds up, frankly, to consigning a large share of our population to an earlier death than would otherwise be the case.
Do we have any concrete figures on how many people out there have coverage and are satisfied with the coverage that they have? Gail?
Well, it's a large number, and when people start feeling threatened, that number tends to go up. It's about 80% of the people who have coverage say they are satisfied or very satisfied with their health care, at least when they are perceiving that something might happen to change what they have. That's what has always made this so tough. Most people have coverage. Most people, when faced with a choice of having something unknown in their future, say, I like what I have. The issue the president's been trying to make, and there is some validity in this, is you may be happy with what you have, but if we don't do something to reform health care, you shouldn't assume that will be there in your future.
At 27 before the hour, you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And as someone who recently had to make use of this health care system after I fell and broke my pelvis, I was in the hospital for 9 days, 5 days in the hospital, 4 days in rehab. And the whole time I was thinking to myself, if I hadn't had health insurance, what would I have done? Would they have turned me away? So what would have happened?
Well, actually, because you had an emergency situation, that is the one area where we do have provisions, even for people who are here illegally. The name is called EMTALA. It's a provision that says if somebody shows up at the hospital in an emergency situation, you must provide them with care. And it's one of the areas that is aggressively followed. A hospital will lose its Medicare certification if it turns you away.
And so everybody, all of us, are paying for those kinds of
visits. For emergencies.
For emergencies.
If you have an ongoing problem, you have cancer that requires continued intervention, that becomes much trickier. But if you fall, if you're in a car accident, that hospital better not turn you away, or it is likely to face very serious trouble.
So how much is that contributing to the increased cost for everybody, Ralph?
All the studies show that emergency care costs every single family $1,000 per year. Just that we're compensating for those who don't have that kind of insurance. I want to just very briefly build on the quality issue that Susan was talking about and what you were talking about, how many people die because they don't have health insurance. There are a number of studies, including one by the Institute of Medicine. There are a couple hundred thousand Americans who die every year because of preventable medical errors, and millions of others who were infected, either in the hospital and outside of the hospital. If the American people knew that to be the case, that there were two jumbo jets crashing to the surface of this country every single year, they'd be doing something about it and would be much more passionate about demanding reform. This is a quality issue that's got to be addressed. It's
I want to go back to a point you made, Gail, about everybody having some form of financial, of health insurance, and sort of moving that in gradually, perhaps this soft start, as you say. How you're talking then about 20% of the American people who are without insurance.
15. Of the total American population.
Okay, so you're talking about saying that they must have some form of insurance. Now, if they don't, cannot afford it, what happens?
Well, understand that the people who are below 133% of the poverty line, the very poor and the lowest low income, will be covered completely with the subsidy. Where you start having people in a more difficult position is when they're at 300% of the poverty line, which is roughly about
$60,000
a year. Now, the question of what do you do? Well, these are people who are filing income tax. You can impose a penalty. You can, this is will always, of course, be subject to audit. People who show up in a position at the hospitals or who have to attest on their income tax forms that they do or do not have health insurance coverage. You have ways when you're talking about people who are interacting with the system, with the IRS, with others, to be able to impose a penalty if you choose.
Gail Wilensky of Project Hope, Ralph Neese at the National Coalition on Healthcare, Susan Dancer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. When we come back, we'll open the phones for your questions, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by this and other NPR member stations, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, and by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at FordFoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Future of Faith, leading theologian Harvey Cox on why social justice and spirituality will be central to Christianity in the 21st century. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll go right to the phones as we talk about healthcare reform. First to Charles. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Diane. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm about to lose my battery on my cell phone, so I'll make this quick and take my answer off the line.
Okay.
Everyone talks about of doing something with health care, but I don't hear much about the cost of doing nothing. The other comment I would have is, there's a lack of efficiency measures in health care. Some of the basic elements that are usually employed from systems engineers processes seem to be lacking in health care, and I would just want to hear comments on that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Susan.
Well, if you look at what will happen in this country if we do not lower the rate of health spending growth, we published some research at Health Affairs on this recently. Over the next 75 years, if we do nothing, 119% of all the increase in national income from now over the next 75 years will go to health care. That means every additional dollar the economy generates, plus some that is already going to other uses. Now, if we slow that rate of growth of cost, so it's just 1% faster, healthcare spending grows 1% faster than real gross domestic product, then only 55% of the increase in real national income goes to health spending. So half, in the best of all circumstances, we're going to have enormous amounts of money sucked into healthcare.
Can we put this into individual terms? Part of the problem here is that people hear these huge numbers. They hear 75 years out, and they think, I can't think about
this. Well, here's how
I
try to do it.
Good.
So 75 years from now, let's say we have Sasha Obama and Jenna Bush's daughter are co-chairing the presidency of the United States. Let's say it's a whole different system. They're flying over the country, looking down. What do they see if health spending growth continues at its current rate? They see almost everybody in the country either getting health care or providing health care, and very little else going on economically. That is, you know, that sounds like a fantasy world. But if you look at the projections, that is just about what could happen. And imagine how much health care would cost when almost everybody, half of the population at least, is in the business of generating health care.
This problem is so bad that you've got Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and Peter Orszag and David Walker, the former Comptroller General, all saying that the only way to address the economic catastrophe is to first rein in the increase of yearly costs in health care. That has to be done. Your caller also asked about wasteful and inefficiencies in the system. It's 30 to 40% of that $2.5 trillion. Three, four separate studies from business, from medicine, from all kinds of institutions. That $750 billion a year that could be saved by wise spending, that would pay for health care reform.
If Chuck Grassley were sitting here right now, what would he say about this, Gail?
I don't think he would disagree with the basic premise that we spend a lot and that there is low-value care. After all, he comes from Iowa. Iowa has very low spending compared to Southern California
then
or Miami.
Why isn't he out there pushing for this
plan?
The
problem, well, because it's not clear this plan, whichever plan you mean, actually does much to rein in spending. It's very hard. We believe, well, I don't know if the number is $700 billion, but it's some substantial number of low-value or no-value health care. How to try to change what we have, a lot of physicians working in small practices, single specialty, being paid on a fee-for-service basis, which encourages more and more complex services. How we try to redefine healthcare delivery that will reward institutions and clinicians who provide high quality care at low price, take care of their malpractice concerns on defensive medicine, make sure everybody has coverage. That's very difficult, much more difficult than people have been willing to talk about, but very important.
Here's an email from John. I'm a smart individual, a news junkie, keep up to date. But even I don't understand what will happen with health care. President Obama has made it clear what he wants from reform. Everyone knows that's not going to happen. The president can go on every talk show in town, clarify what he wants from health care, but it won't matter because Congress and the Senate have different ideas in mind. I feel the confusion and outrage regarding reform is being misdirected at the president and should be directed to the elected politicians who are actually writing the bill. Ralph.
There's much of that I agree with. The president has been, for the last few weeks, the teacher in chief. He's been trying to bring the American people with him on health care reform. And from a civil rights background, that's important so we can have trust in the government and bring the hearts and minds of the American people with us on a law. But the other thing that he has got to focus on is he personally has got to do the LBJ FDR type of negotiations. He's got to be a leader one senator at a time, one House member at a time, until he gets his 60, until he gets his 218, with the help of the congressional leadership.
All right, to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Harley. You're on the air.
Good morning to you.
Go right ahead, sir.
I cannot believe that I'm talking to you, but I'm so pleased that I am. I am a an ophthalmologist. I've practiced for more than 40 years, and I'm an old Goldwater Republican, and I was violently opposed to Medicare when it came in, and I have lived with it because, being an ophthalmic surgeon, I have mostly Medicare-receiving patients. And even though my fees are for my primary service are about one-fourth what they were when Medicare came in, I believe that it is a wonderful system for everybody concerned.
And that is your very, very thoughtful statement, Susan.
And in fact, there are some surveys that have come out recently that suggest much the same thing, that for all of the Sturm und Drang and angst that was felt by the medical profession before Medicare was passed, actually, they've learned to live with it. They find Medicare is a pretty good partner, a pretty reliable payer. Sometimes it pays bills even faster than the private insurance market does.
All
so
right.
There is much to be said.
Let me point us all to an op-ed piece in today's Wall Street Journal, where Newt Gingrich writes that the president and congressional Democrats' health care plans will stifle health care innovation. Help me to understand that argument, Gail.
The concern is, if you put an excise tax on medical devices or you put taxes on pharmaceuticals, that you will take away some of the profits that have been used in innovation. There's a grain of truth that if you try to slow down spending, which we all believe in this room absolutely has to happen, that you won't have quite as much money available for investment. The fact is, we cannot tolerate having healthcare spending grow at 2.5 percentage points faster than the rest of the economy. That's what Ben Bernanke, that's what David Walker, that's what Peter Orszag and Bob Reichauer, former CBO directors, have all said. And we have a lot of indication that a lot of that spending has low value or no value. Nobody is saying lock in 17% of the GDP. As Susan indicated, we're going to see growth almost no matter what. The question is, can we slow it down? Can we improve the value? We better.
I'm sure we could slow it down if we stopped spending so much money television advertising. See Allison Viagra. I mean, it really is... more than repetitive.
And to build on what Gail said, what this would probably do is put a tighter sieve on innovation, because it will be the case, I believe, if health reform passes, that device manufacturers, others, will still be able to innovate. They're just going to have to prove that what they're bringing out really does add value for patients. And in that respect, I think that really truly effective innovation probably will get an even greater spur out of this legislation than not.
All right. To Kendall, New York. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I've just got a couple comments to make.
Sure.
And a question.
All right.
All right. Pat Moynihan, my favorite senator, years ago said when the Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid problems about them going broke, said take the cap off that we pay. I think it stops now around $105,000. Take the cap off.
You're talking about Social Security.
And Medicaid, too.
No,
Medicare,
there's
there's no cap on that.
Oh, there isn't?
No.
Well, could we increase the percentage that people pay and allow them to enroll in it now and include all bonuses and federal employees in this program?
The problem is not only healthcare spending in general is unsustainable, Medicare in particular is also unsustainable because it mimics the rest of healthcare spending. So we have a problem of how are we going to pay for all of the promises that we have made. And frankly, the Republicans made this worse in 2003 when they passed a very important addition, outpatient prescription drugs, but without any funding. That added another $30 trillion to unfunded liability.
How much?
much? $30 trillion of unfunded liability to the Medicare program. So adding a little more Medicare tax, you can count on that that's part of your future. We still need to slow down that spending.
All right, to Williamsburg, Virginia. Good morning, Courtney.
Good morning. My question relates to the possibility of Senator Snowe's compromise plan for a trigger option. It seems to me that this is the kind of plan that can possibly appease members on the left and the right, wherein it says to people who are ardent free market supporters, maybe the free market can work this system out, that if we truly put a real present threat to insurance companies, that they will make insurance affordable to the American population, and there will be increased coverage. For liberals, there's an option that should the free market, under the most stringent duress, not adapt, that public option can come in as a concession. Is this not a real possibility for the future of the debate?
Yes, it is a possibility, but it's also the case that many people look at the trigger to a public option and don't like that. So the problem is this is a chess game. As you move a piece one way to court one member or even a set of members, you could lose other members on the other side. And we just do not know, frankly, at this point where the majority is on that question of a trigger.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Akron, Ohio. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning. Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I was just wondering what they were going to do. I know they keep talking that they are going to have subsidies for these people, but I don't see where these subsidies are going to actually cover the cost of health insurance. When they make $7.75 an hour or $10 an hour, I mean, how much are they going to have to give them? And also, I've not yet heard in this debate ever, that doctors have to make concessions. I mean, it's pretty obvious you can't get a handle on cost unless you tell these people they can't make that much money. Yeah. When they live in million-dollar mansions, and I just don't understand how they're ever going to get a handle on it if they can't be told you can't make that much money.
I appreciate your call, Gail.
The lowest income people will have a full cost of either Medicaid or, at least according to the Baucus plan, will be able to take the money that would have gone to buy them into Medicare and be able to purchase a private health insurance plan. As you go up the income scale and you get away from the close to the poverty line, there will be subsidies, but they will begin to slide. Now, health insurance varies a lot in cost, and you see it most easily if you look at the Federal Employees Health Care Plan, where the mail handlers union costs about $5,500 a year, and the standard Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is actually a high option plan, costs about $13,000 a year for a family of four. So part of it will also depend on what's available. It's why this health insurance exchange that's been talking about, a place where people who don't have employer-sponsored insurance coverage can go, be clear what they're buying, receive their subsidies, and have some assurance that they're not going to get ripped off.
The questioner had another point about the doctors and about providers and parts of the health industrial complex. In June 1st, the six leading players made proposals to the president. We can voluntarily, over the next 10 years, cut the rate of annual growth 1.5% and save $1 trillion to $1.7 trillion over 10 years. You know what? Voluntary efforts usually don't work. Why don't we put that into the bill and make it enforceable, get a trigger? It doesn't have to go in place. Let's let the private industries work. But if they don't work, they don't do the 1.5% or 1%, then make it enforceable after 3 to 5 years.
Susan. One quick point. With respect to Medicare, there actually is some internal redistribution in the Baucus bill for doctors under Medicare. Primary care physicians would get paid a little bit more. Others would see their rate of growth of payment constrained. So not all doctors will come out swimmingly. out of this bill.
Here's an interesting final email from Robert. He says, I've never heard anyone explain what the added value is of insurance companies. There's no insurance company between me and my Medicare. What a value do insurance companies add to health care?
Well, as somebody who used to run the Medicare program, let me explain what Medicare does not do. It doesn't look to try to provide coordination of care. It doesn't try to see whether there is quality assurance directly in terms of what is being provided. Medicare does many things well. It's old-fashioned a la carte fee-for-service medicine where there are silos in physician, hospital, drug support. It is not the model of our future.
Gail Walensky, Ralph Nee, Susan Dentzer, really a great discussion. Thank you so much. I learned a lot this morning.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening, and we'll have more programs regarding health care. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.